or good evening, depending on where you are in the world. Welcome to this week's Information Week Live. I'm your host, Executive Editor Dave Wagner. In case you were wondering where our usual host, Kurt Franklin, is, he's stuck on an airplane. Katy Perry sprained her ankle, and they asked Kurt to fill in as the halftime entertainment at the Super Bowl. They picked him because he looked great in her dress. Despite missing Kurt, we've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking about phones, the cloud, how robots are taking over all of our jobs, and we'll talk about which IT celebrity names his dogs after cookies, the eating kind, not the tracking kind. Before we get too hungry for cookies, I wanted to welcome Bill Coughlin. Bill is the corporate archivist for AT&T. He runs the nation's largest corporate archives with over 45,000 cubic feet of records and 15,000 artifacts dating back to 1869. He's here to talk about a special anniversary for one of the most ubiquitous pieces of business technology there is, the phone. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks very much, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Oh, sure. We're glad you're here. So, Bill, as you know, this week, Sunday, I believe, marked the 100th anniversary of the first transcontinental phone call. Was it just some mom nagging her son about why he never writes anymore, or was there a little more import to this call? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So really what it was the ceremonial opening of AT&T's transcontinental telephone service. It was the first time that the East Coast was connected to the West Coast, and AT&T had been building out its long-distance network for a number of decades. And the furthest that it had extended up to 1911 was Denver. But the technology didn't exist to actually transport the human voice further than that. So after the invention of the three-element vacuum tube, AT&T possessed the technology to extend the line all the way to San Francisco. It was built actually in time for the San Francisco World's Fair, which was supposed to open in 1914, but the fair was delayed a bit. And so on January 25th, 1915, you have the famous ceremonial call with Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone. He is at AT&T headquarters in New York City, and he is conversing with his former assistant, Thomas Watson, who is at a telephone building in San Francisco. And that call kicks off about 4:30 p.m. Eastern time, and it would continue until about 8 o'clock that evening. It was a series of rolling conversations with a lot of famous personalities, dignitaries, and officials. But the first conversation, of course, is between Bell and Watson. Later on, the president of AT&T, Theodore Vail, who was really the visionary behind this long-distance network, he was participating from his winter home on Jekyll Island, Georgia. He was supposed to be at headquarters in New York, but he had injured his leg and he was marooned in Georgia. And so a special line was strung from his home up to headquarters. And so he was also able to participate. And then later on in the afternoon, you had President Wilson at the White House, who also congratulates Mr. Bell and Watson for the great achievement. And then all four men participate in really what was often called the first conference call.
Right. I was actually just going to ask you that I think it's fun that one of the first transcontinental calls was a conference call, basically like all of us have to deal with every day. It also must be fun to be the president of a phone network and have a special line rolled out for you just for a call.
Yeah. Yeah, because that line, I mean, that extended about 1,000 miles. And so,
right.
Technically, I mean, the line from New York to San Francisco is about 3,400 miles. And that was the furthest distance that the human voice had ever been transmitted. But also, when you factor in Vail participating, you know, his voice went an extra 1,000 miles to San Francisco. So it was quite a feat.
Right. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you that. How does one accomplish that in 1915? I think we obviously we always sort of underestimate our ancestors, but it seems like quite a physical feat to draw to bring lines going all the way from New York to San Francisco with 1915 technology.
It was. In fact, I mean the technology was fairly simple. It's just copper telephone wire. Placed, you know, strung from telephone pole across the country. But to erect those poles through some very difficult terrain was an arduous process. And AT&T started building up that last leg in 1913. And then they completed the line in June of 1914. And there's a famous photograph, I know you've actually posted on your website, that shows the linemen stringing that final connection, and he's waving the American flag. And so that was in Wendover, Utah. That was the final link. And so the line was ready for usage at that point. AT&T tested it about a month later. But again, as I mentioned before, it was delayed. The opening of the line was delayed until January of 1915.
Right. Thank you, by the way, for bringing up that slideshow. We put up what I think are some really fun and really interesting pictures on Sunday for the anniversary. We'll get that link to you in the chat. Speaking of chat, if you're not already in our chat room, everybody please log into our chat room and join the conversation. One of the most fun parts about Information Week Live is that it is an interactive process. You and other professionals get to participate in the chat, ask questions of our guests, talk to each other about your professional experiences. So please dive in there if you haven't already. Bill, one of the things that I thought was really fun, I don't think I got a chance to put in my article, but you put in your press release the transcript of the beginning of that conversation between Bell and Watson. And if memory serves, it started with "Ahoy, ahoy, ahoy." Was that a typical way one started a phone conversation in 1915, or is that just a bellism?
That was a bellism. You have to remember, he was Scottish, and when he invented the telephone, he thought that the proper way of initiating a call was to say "hoy, hoy," and of course that never caught on. I mean, Americans simply say hello, or you know, other ways of greeting their callers. But he continued to use that even after 1876.
He never got it to catch on, poor guy.
No.
Thankfully, the phone caught on. One of the things that we talked about briefly, but I want to talk about a little bit more, was how you referred to this call as the world's first conference call. Is that something that then became a common part of the technology right away? Did we see business conference calls conducted in, you know, the few years after that? Or was that something that was done especially for the event?
That was something that was done especially for the event. Conference calls really didn't catch on until decades later. But what was commonplace, of course, at the time on even local phone calls was party line service. And so if you'll remember, subscribers would have a telephone number, but there would be other callers that would share that same line. And so they would have to ring the operator, and the operator would connect them to somebody else. But it was a shared line. There were different levels of party line service, you know, 4 people, 8 people, and so on. And that was pretty prevalent in 1915.
Right, right.
Especially for residential users, because phone service was very expensive. And even in 1915, it was primarily a business tool. That's how it was conceived. And it didn't really become a mass market item until the late 20s. But in 1915, it would have been expensive for just the normal household.
Right, I can imagine. It's interesting you brought up as a business tool, because obviously we're Information Week. We're talking about the enterprise, technology used in the enterprise. One of the things that I think we take for granted these days is that in a lot of ways, the phone is the first piece of information technology. It is a real, it is information at its purest, and it's technology as well. Would you agree with that assessment? And do you, How do you think it evolved or changed business in its early years?
I do agree with you on that assessment. And in fact, AT&T was mindful of the significance of this coast-to-coast calling. I mean, they actually produced a pamphlet on the aftermath called The Story of a Great Achievement, Telephone Communication from Coast to Coast. And in it, it says, everyone felt that he was taking part in an epic-making event, that in the future, school children would be made to learn January 25th, 1915, as one of the big dates in the world's scientific, commercial, and political history. And certainly, you touched upon the business aspect, the commercial nature of the telephone. And with the linkage of East and West Coasts, it really made national commerce a lot more efficient. I mean, of course, there was communications before that. People could send telegrams. But to actually pick up a phone and talk to somebody on the other side of the world or the other side of the country was a huge asset.
Right, great. Well, I want to keep talking about that, but I have been told, funny enough, by our audience that there's some really bad background noise going on the phone, which I think is pretty ironic considering we're 100 years from that, and I want to apologize. I don't know how to fix it because it sounds perfectly clear on our end. We're going to do what we can to try to clean this up for you guys, and in the meantime, I want to apologize. And so, Bill, back to where we were going, a business tool, were there other major moments, major milestones that really brought that on? For instance, I'm thinking maybe the first transatlantic call or something like that. Were there other major moments where the phone really took off as a business tool?
Yes, absolutely. And so, an interesting aspect of this ceremonial call in 1915 is that the engineers, the AT&T engineers who had perfected it, immediately started working on a means of transmitting the human voice via wireless. And so the AT&T started a series of experiments that year, and in September, they were actually able to transmit the voice from New York to Arlington, Virginia, and from there by radio telephone to San Francisco, a distance of 2,500 miles. And then a month later, AT&T was also able to transmit the human voice from Virginia to the Eiffel Tower in Paris. And that same call was heard again at San Francisco, at Mare Island, the naval station at San Francisco, and at the naval station at Honolulu. And so AT&T knew that this was going to be the future, and it continued to pour in resources developing radio telephony. And the first transatlantic telephone service, commercial service, was launched by the company on January 7th, 1927. And again, it was primarily meant to be a business tool because it was very expensive to call overseas. But that was the beginning of AT&T's overseas telephone network. It would continue to expand. In 1934, it was the opening of a trans-Pacific service where you could call from the U.S. to China or to Japan at that point. And so little by little, you know, the world became much smaller because of telecommunications.
Right. Well, that's exciting. I'm only a couple miles from your island. Maybe I should go there and see if my phone will work better. I'm really interested in the wireless technology you're talking about. So just as we're finally stringing wire from New York to San Francisco, we're already thinking about getting rid of the wire. So 100 years later now, we have these smartphones, these little computers in our hands that are all wireless. But you guys were already laying the foundation for it a century ago. That's really interesting. How much longer after 1915 would it be before wireless would become a common use? Is it just the cellular phone that we see, or was there more wireless telephone? I'm not sure, but that I don't know about that happened before that.
Yeah, no, there were other wireless versions. Now, what we're talking about really is two-way radio. So almost like the car phone that police officers used going back to the 1920s. It's that basic technology. So that was what was used on the transatlantic service and then transpacific service. But for mobile telephone service, AT&T launched that in 1946. St. Louis was the first city in the country to have it. And then little by little, it was opened in other major cities and along major highway routes. And it was called mobile telephone service. You would have a car phone under your dashboard, and the driver would simply pick up the phone, and an operator would answer, and then she would interconnect you with somebody either on another car phone or within the wired network. And so most people don't realize that there was commercial mobile telephone service going back to 46. And then that technology was improved in 1965, and it was called improved mobile telephone service, or IMTS. And the difference was AT&T had added the rotary dial to the phone, so you could actually place your own calls from the car. And then after that, AT&T continued to experiment and perfect wireless communications. It came up with cellular technology, had that capability in the late 60s, early 70s, but it wasn't launched commercially until 1983, and that was on October 13th in Chicago, the first city in the United States to have commercial cellular service.
Wow, that's really neat. I love the idea of rotary dialing on a mobile phone. That just strikes me as incredibly humorous. I'm always a big fan of the rotary phone. As a kid, we still had a rotary phone. I always enjoyed the sound and the click. It felt very physical. It always felt like a phone should feel. When I lost my rotary phone, it really felt less connected. Do you have any? Speaking of rotary phones, I know this is going to sound like a funny question, but do you have any favorite phones? I think everybody growing up at certain ages has a phone that they remember, that when they think phone, they think that. Through the 100-year history of the phone, is there one that you just think is just beautiful or cool or just a major step forward?
Yeah, I have several, but probably my first would be the Model 302 desk set that came out in 1937. And so that was the first telephone that had the ringing mechanism built inside. Before that, you would have a telephone that would sit on your desk, but then you'd have this clunky wooden box that had the bells inside, and it would be connected by wire to your telephone. But Henry Dreyfuss, the famous industrial designer, designed this beautiful phone, the 302, and it's just very elegant. It's almost, you know, an Art Deco shape, very streamlined. So I find that very appealing. And also, I mean, you have that phone on your slideshow, but there's another one, too, that I like just because of the funky nature of it. It was the Sculptura design line phone that came out in the 70s. It was also nicknamed the donut phone because of its shape. But that's one of the more unusual phones that I have in my telephone collection here at the archives.
I love that phone, too. I think it's very cool. We also got a vote on in our chat room from Jastrop for the Princess phone. So we have some real phone fans out there and people who remember specific phones. I've always been a big fan of the Mickey Mouse phone, too, just because I like Disney. Now, this is going to be another funny question. I'm going to preface it with a very quick story of my own. I remember working in an office one day, and we were pelted by dozens and dozens of calls in a row from a fax machine beeping in our ear. And then a friend of mine answered the phone and picked it up and answered it with, "Beep, beep yourself, Mr. Fax Machine." And it turned out to be the person apologizing for calling us over and over again on the fax machine. And that's my sort of favorite phone mishap story. Do you have any phone stories as an archivist, either something, a recurring problem or just a fun story about phone mishaps or phone phone fun that you know about?
Not off the top of my head, I don't. No.
I'll have to think about that.
Yeah,
that's a good question for the chat room. Anybody have a phone story they want to bring up, go ahead and bring it up in there. Speaking of the chat room, I have a couple more questions for Bill, but before I get to those questions, I want to remind everybody of the chat room. If you're not participating in the chat, you're missing about half the fun of Information Week. A lot of fun professionals having good conversations about their experiences with phones, both in business and without. We're going to talk about other topics later today, including cloud and AI. So hop in there, join that conversation, because it's a great place to engage with your fellow audience. So thanks, Bill. I want to talk a little bit about the future of the phone. Now, I know you're an archivist, but you probably have a better sense of context of the way the phone has changed in the last 100 years than anybody else will ever talk to. Do you have a sense of where the phone is headed in the next few years and just for fun, maybe the next 100 years?
Well, I'm certainly not a futurist, so my guess is as good as anybody's. But if I had to venture a guess of what it's going to look like 100 years from now, I would think wireless is certainly going to be the norm. That's the means of transmitting voice and data that'll still be around. And like today, where wearables are the hot thing, perhaps 100 years from now it would be implantables. And maybe humans would be cyborgs, and they would have the technology implanted in their brains. And that way they could actually just kind of think of someone they wanted to call and have a conversation telepathically, you know, that's transmitted by wireless. But who knows? I mean, I really can't say.
Well, if I ever do get an implant in my head to make calls, I'm going to start with hoy, hoy, hoy. So do you know, does AT&T have any plans for the first Earth-to-Moon call or Earth-to-Mars call in the next couple of years? Do you think we'll be seeing that in the future of the phone as well?
Well, that's already happened.
Well,
President Nixon actually called the astronauts when they were on the moon in 1969.
But, yeah, tell me about that. Tell me about communication to the moon. It sounds like you were about to tell me a story there.
Yeah, so AT&T had been hired by the federal government to provide all of the space communications for the NASA program. And the company developed a technology that would allow people on Earth to communicate with the astronauts, you know, walking the moon. And so there's a famous conversation by President Nixon talking to, I think it was Neil Armstrong, and we actually have footage of that on the AT&T Tech Channel. We've placed a number of historical movies online, and there is one called Nixon Calls the Moon, and you can check it out.
Oh, wow. So Nixon picked up a regular, what we would think of as a regular old phone?
Yes, he was just calling from a rotary, I think it was a rotary dial phone, if I remember correctly, and he's at the White House, and he's talking to astronauts on the moon.
Wow. And what did they have on their end? Did it look like a rotary phone, too? Or
no, it would have been, you know, the radio sets that were in their helmets.
Right. I like the idea of a wire stretching. Well, that's really fascinating. Are there any other archived films like that we should be thinking about going to see at your site?
Well, since we are commemorating the 100th anniversary of the transcontinental telephone line, there is one. It's a recreation. It was filmed in 1940, and it actually shows how AT&T strung the line, and there's a reenactment of the lineman going up the pole and waving the American flag, and all the officials around him are taking off their hats and cheering, and that's a fun one to look at. But there's a lot of great films on the site. I mean, talking about the different products and services. I know some of the listeners mentioned that Princess was their famous or their favorite phones, and so there are films about the different types of phones that AT&T manufactured, including Princess and Trimline and the Designline series. So I would urge the listeners to go to the website. It's AT&T Tech Channel, and there are about 320 movies online.
Wow, that's very cool. I can tell you firsthand, I saw the movie of the reenactment of the Stringing of the Line, and it was very interesting. I think it was narrated by Bing Crosby, at least a voice very similar to Bing Crosby. I thought it was a very interesting movie. So I encourage all of our guests to check that out. Could you give the site address again, please?
Yes, it's called the AT&T Tech Channel. So I think if you do just simply HTTP, it would be techchannel1word.att.com. And then there are a series of segments, but you would be looking for the AT&T Archives segment, and there are about 320 plus films online.
Great. And if you have a second when you join the chat, you can feel free to post that link again. And if not,
sure,
one of our editors will try to post that link for everybody to see as well. Unfortunately, we're running low on time. So what I'd like to ask is what we always end every Information Week Live show with, which is if we want to follow you or anything your business is doing on social media, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, where would be the way to find you? For that kind of information, so we can keep following you.
Following me or following the company?
Following you or the archives or any interesting thing you guys are doing.
Well, that's not really available to the public because we're a small staff. We primarily exist to serve AT&T company activities, so we don't have a social media presence.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I'm pretty sure everybody knows they can follow AT&T on Twitter. So I'd like to thank you, Bill. You've been a fantastic guest. Everybody in the chat room is very excited about what you've been talking about. If you have a minute, we'd love for you to drop by, talk to them about some of their questions. Thanks again for joining us, Bill.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to the chat.
Great. That was Bill Coughlin, Corporate Archivist for AT&T. We'd like to thank him. And now we have Kelly Sheridan. I promised you guys we would talk a little bit about which dog lover named his dogs after cookies. Kelly is going to tell us about that. Kelly is Associate Editor of Information Week Live, of Information Week. Welcome, Kelly.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
Good. Thanks. So let's start out with silly dog names. Somebody very famous just didn't ask me anything on Reddit. It turns out that was Bill Gates. What did Bill tell us besides how he names his dogs?
Well, I wish he went into more details about how exactly they were named, but the Ask Me Anything was actually fascinating to read. It's been a while since I've read an interview with Bill Gates, so it was interesting to learn more about him from a more personal perspective. And the Reddit users were just all over the place asking him whatever they wanted, and he talked about everything from Bitcoin to Secret Santa. Apparently he participated in Reddit's Secret Santa, which I just found out is an actual thing. You have thousands of people exchanging gifts all over the world, which is actually really cool. And some lucky woman got Bill Gates to send her a Loki helmet, which I wasn't entirely sure what that was, but after looking it up, I found out it's related to Marvel. And a pillow that looks like a polio virus, and a coffee book table of Africa pictures, and he shared what he received online, which was cool. He let us know that he is definitely afraid of machine intelligence, which I thought was interesting, and let us know that he is working with Microsoft on a personal agent that sounds mysteriously like Cortana.
I want to talk about all of those things, but first I just want to say that it's sad that you don't know what a Loki helmet is, because it's a giant horned helmet. And the idea of Bill Gates sending one of those through the mail is just amusing to me. I'd love to know what the FedEx guy thought when they delivered that package.
Yeah, apparently it arrived in pieces, but the recipient seemed confident that she'd be able to fix it.
Oh, good. Well, she wanted it, so she must know what it looked like. So one of the things I found fascinating about that was his fear about AI. He joins Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking on this. What was Bill Gates' problem with AI?
Well, it seems that he feels artificial intelligence will evolve over time to the point where it poses a risk to us. He didn't add quite that much detail, but he did say that at first in machines' earlier stages, I guess, we're sort of getting started on that now. Machines will start to do jobs for humans, and that'll bring positive outcomes so long as it's managed well. But over the course of a few decades, the intelligence will strengthen, and he sides with those who believe that that does indeed impose a risk to humans, and a lot of people he thinks aren't concerned enough about that risk.
What do you want us to do about it? Stop?
I didn't say, actually. I wish he went into more detail about that because I'd be fascinated in hearing what exactly those risks are and how he thinks it'll evolve over time. But hopefully he will participate in another interview where someone will have the chance to ask him more about that.
Yeah, maybe you can, since you're a resident Microsoft expert.
I would love to.
There was another thing I thought was interesting. You said he really liked Bitcoin. Did he go into why he liked Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin has been suffering quite a lot lately in the press.
Right. Well, he did say it is an exciting new technology, and he seems to think that it has potential, but for his philanthropic purposes, it doesn't seem to have much value. Just because when providing currency to the poor, you can't really give them something that goes up or down, especially something with as much risk as Bitcoin, in relation to their local currency. And if there's a mistake in whom they pay, the people in the countries that he's working in need to be able to reverse their mistakes. And Bitcoin's anonymous, so it kind of wouldn't work along with their priorities.
Oh, fascinating. I wonder how many Bitcoin is in $40 billion or whatever Bill Gates has right now.
You and me both.
So, when he talked about that and vaccines and some other things, did he mention any new things that he was working on there?
He went into more detail on his specific projects in the Gates letter. I included the link in the article that I wrote. But in general, he seems to think that over the past 30 years, they've made great strides in improving life for residents of poorer countries. It seems like he's specifically focusing on Africa. But he's aiming to make even more improvements over the course of the next 15 years, so kind of cutting the time span in half and doubling his productivity. And he's focusing on his specific goals seem to be decreasing the mortality rate among children in these countries by providing different vaccines and sustaining agriculture in poor countries and giving them more nutritious food over a longer period of time, and providing better access to digital banking and education all through technology. So all really great causes and all something that he's really trying to buckle down on fixing over the next 15 years.
Sounds really impressive. Let's talk Microsoft as a whole. There have been a lot of big announcements coming out in the last week. Including, I suppose, that Bill Gates is working with Microsoft on something again. What's the big news from Microsoft this week?
Well, we kicked off this week with Microsoft's quarterly earnings call. They reported that profits fell, revenue increased by 8%, but income fell by 10%. But overall, it was a decent report. This is for the final quarter of the end of 2014. Shining stars included their cloud computing business and the Surface tablet, which broke records with $1.1 billion in sales, And they also had an impressive porter with the Windows Phone, which is a fairly recent thing, so they were happy with that. It seems that they're trying, in putting everything in context, of course, it seems like Windows 10 is going to be a big deal this year, so I think they're trying to prepare for that as well.
Right. You and I had a conversation online a little bit about this, but I took note of how many physical things Microsoft is into now, Xbox, phone, Surface. Obviously, they're a software company. Do you see this as a new part of Microsoft's strategy, or is this just a sort of aberration?
Well, it looks like they're definitely placing a great focus on hardware. I remember writing a couple weeks ago a story about how they're focusing really on pushing their mobile phones to lower-income markets and trying to increase the number of people who just have their products. And obviously, Surface will be a big focus going forward. I think they're trying to expand their hardware so that more people right now will obtain Windows devices so that when the free upgrade comes for Windows 10, that falls into the hands of more people. So I think they're really trying to maximize the number of people who have Windows devices so that more people can experience Windows 10 when it comes out.
Right. Would it be fair to say that this is an Apple-like strategy, or am I saying an evil word that I shouldn't say to anybody who covers Microsoft?
Actually, haven't thought too much about that. You could say that. They're definitely trying to compete with Apple in terms of getting their devices into the hands of more people. But I guess only time will tell whether that is an effective strategy for them.
Right. How has there been an indication so far of how people are receiving Windows 10? Obviously, we're only seeing previews and demonstrations, but is there a belief that Windows 10 is being received better than Windows 8 was?
I've heard mixed reviews on the technical preview, which was released late last week. It seems that some people who have downloaded the preview onto their desktop, they like it. They think the interface is a little bit bland, but think that's something that will improve over time. But overall, I think it's getting, so far, a better response than Windows 8 ever got. I mean, people just hated that. Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 were not received well by the consumer masses. So given the very early stages of Windows 10, I think it has a positive outlook. Looking forward to seeing what the mobile preview brings. That's set to come out in February, I believe. So it'll be interesting to see how that compares to the desktop preview, whether it's more advanced, whether it needs more work, or whether people seem to like that more than they like the desktop version. Some people have had issues downloading Windows 10 onto Surface products, I believe, but I don't know if that's because those are more mobile-suited devices as opposed to desktop computers.
Right. Well, that doesn't sound like a good start for Microsoft.
Yeah.
Downloading the preview. Have you gotten a chance for anybody who hasn't gotten a chance? Have you gotten a chance to see it, even if you haven't gotten a chance to touch it? Does it look like Windows 8? Does it look more like Windows 7? What does it look like?
I've seen screenshots of it. I haven't seen the actual Windows 10 yet for myself. It seems like they're trying to appease fans of Windows 7 who hated Windows 8, and they're also trying to appease those who liked Windows 8. For example, the start menu comes in two formats. You have your traditional small bar on the bottom start menu that we're all used to, and then you have the Windows 8 start menu. Windows 10 gives you the option to use either of those, which I heard is a little bit cumbersome and kind of a waste of time. I think people kind of wish that Microsoft would just choose one. But I think that's the point of having a test process like this, so that people can try out both versions and provide their feedback to Microsoft, which is why they're doing the test preview in the first place. And I'm hoping that they'll gather enough feedback so that they can just pick one for the final release. But who knows what they'll decide to go with.
Right. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but you actually have a slideshow coming soon for Information Week that's going to show some screenshots of some of the things Microsoft is working on. Is that right?
Yes. Should go up later this afternoon. Microsoft just released a version of Outlook for iOS and Android mobile devices. The iOS version is the full release, and the Android version is just a test preview, presumably, so they can get more feedback from users. But I'll also be releasing some images of the Microsoft Office for Android tablets, which also released yesterday after a 3-month preview period. So a lot of new stuff coming out on the mobile front this week. It all looks really cool, especially the Outlook for iOS and Android. Really looking forward to trying that for myself. I'm going to be downloading that definitely. Makes email super easy on the go, and it really integrates the calendar function of Outlook into a mobile phone so that you can manage all your meetings and send invites and figure out when you have free time for different meetings. Makes it super easy to do all of that. So I think that'll be great for professionals and for just everyday consumers.
Great. Well, in addition to that, where can we follow you for any future Microsoft news?
Well, all of my posts are obviously on Information Week, but I also post a lot of things on Twitter. You can follow me at Kelly Sheridan. That's KellySheridan 22.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, Kelly. We're really looking forward to hearing more about it.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Great. Well, now we move on to Charlie Babcock. Charlie is the editor at large of Information Week, and he is our resident cloud expert. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, David. Pleased to be here.
Great. Well, we're glad to have you. So I hear this week there's been quite a lot going on in cloud, particularly with Amazon starting to tell us a little bit more about its customers and what the competition is going to do about it. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening there?
Well, Amazon is making great progress on a couple of fronts. On the one hand, you have the retail business, which revenues grew by 20% to nearly $89 billion a year. That makes them larger than Target. They'll probably from here on out be overtaking one major retailer after the other. But a really striking statistic I've seen on that fact is over the course of 20 years and over the course of catching up with major retailers, Amazon has only made as much profit as Walmart makes every 35 days. And so there's this discrepancy. You have this growth engine in Amazon that doesn't appear to make any money. And so people are constantly debating that. I have felt that they didn't make much money because they plowed resources into their cloud computing branch. But you couldn't tell that in their revenue reports because they buried whatever revenues were coming from cloud along with whatever expenses were going into it in various ways in their financial reports. For example, our cloud revenue was under the other heading where it was mixed in with their advertising revenue and their co-sponsored credit card earnings. And how were you to tell what was what in that conglomeration? So you end up with a company that reports yet another loss yesterday, and I believe its stock then has gone up. It's a kind of an anomaly, hard to explain in the eyes of the traditional Wall Street analysts.
Right. So,
and I'm sorry, David, I couldn't hear you. I have one of those bad phone connections.
Oh, I'm very sorry. No worries. I just said that it seems like for 20 years Amazon has lost money and had its stock go up. It's very interesting.
Something like that. It certainly hasn't made much money. I think if you were to stack up the 20 years out of the many billions in revenues, hundreds of billions in revenues, I believe it's made a total of $1.9 billion. On the other hand, if you look at the amount that they lost, which I think was $241 million for the year of 2014. That represents, I think, something like 0.02% of revenues. And I think it's clear to a lot of investors that anytime Amazon turns the screws down on their spending and tries to become profitable, they have this tremendous retail and cloud engines that will start producing profits. And I think that's what investors are counting on. But for that to happen, they're going to have to not only compete in retail, but their cloud unit in particular faces increasing competition. And Amazon has to keep investing there to be able to compete with the likes of Microsoft and Google, which have their own deep pockets. And both Microsoft and Google in 2014 showed a much bigger appetite to compete in the cloud arena. And I kind of think Amazon is feeling the heat there. Each of these cloud providers wants data centers all around the world, and accomplishing that takes a lot of money. There have been different estimates, but I think a cloud data center that's a major facility in a new location that opens a new region of the world to you will cost somewhere between $300 million and $500 million. Some estimates have pegged that figure at $1 billion, which I think is too high. But as Amazon continues to expand, the other guys continue to expand, and all parties have started playing a kind of price war game. Amazon has boasted that it will drive down prices in cloud computing, while Microsoft and Google have accepted the challenge. And last year, they took over the lead, and they were, in some cases, the first to drive down prices in a way that Amazon then had to match. And so when you look at an Amazon loss in 2014, you think, well, gee, if Microsoft hadn't lowered prices on storage, that would have been a break-even year for Amazon, or they might have made a profit. And the competition can see this too, that the more they hurt, if they have deep pockets and they hurt Amazon, Amazon is spread thinner in all these different areas than they are, and they might be able to make some headway against Amazon in the cloud if they put pressure on that front. And I think that that's something that's going on right now.
I think it's very funny that Amazon is falling victim to somebody cutting prices on them after all the years they've cut prices on other people.
They've made it very difficult to compete in this arena, but a couple parties like Google and Microsoft hate to see Amazon run off with the whole ball game. And another thing that you see is different parties that are not Amazon stop beating each other's brains out and are trying to kind of tacitly work a little more together to better compete with Amazon. You see this with VMware and Microsoft. You see this with Google and VMware, and you might even see it with Google and Microsoft in certain respects. They all have ways to kind of link their strong technologies together, get them to work a little better in the cloud, and compete more effectively with Amazon.
Well, that's pretty impressive. When you start naming those names as working together, clearly they see Amazon as a threat. Do you think the cloud market still has enough room to grow that basically everybody is going to grow and be okay? Or are we reaching late enough into cloud that we're actually starting to compete over the final size of the pot?
It's still a very young and growing field. The pot will get much larger over the next few years. I can't quote estimates, but right now the takings, the revenues from the cloud are a fraction of what they will be 10 years from now. And so Amazon is kind of running away with it. VMware, Microsoft, Google really don't want to concede that market.
Right.
Amazon went into email this past week as kind of a defensive measure. Both Microsoft and Google offer good email systems, and they work very well with applications in the cloud and as well as with some on-premises software. And Amazon felt it was in danger of losing some of its cloud customers as businesses who might already have a email account with Google or with Microsoft decide to do a little more cloud computing alongside that email account. So now Amazon is in email. And if you're already losing money and you're not an email vendor, then becoming one is going to cost you something. It's going to keep those losses rolling a little longer. And I kind of expect that scenario to be played out a few more times. So where they can, they will force Amazon to go into additional application areas and user areas that are pretty expensive to compete in. But Google, Microsoft, VMware, they have some expertise in competing there. VMware and Google paired up this past week with Google providing some key cloud services that VMware did not have in its public cloud called vCloud Air. Again, I don't think people are going to be moving out of Amazon to go to vCloud Air, but if VMware creates a cloud customer, Google is willing to help VMware keep that cloud customer because then they don't go to Amazon, something like that.
Right. Well, it sounds really interesting. It sounds like something we're going to need you to watch for the next couple of weeks. In the meantime, where can people follow you on Twitter and other social media to keep up with this news?
Well, of course, the best way is informationweek.com, but I have a Twitter handle of Babcock, at BabcockCW, where you could also follow some frequent tweets.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us, Charlie. We're really fascinated by this, and we're looking forward to watching it. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks much, David. Thanks much.
Thanks much.
That was Charlie Babcock, editor-at-large in Information Week. Now we're moving to Tom Claiborne. Tom Claiborne is also an editor-at-large in Information Week, and he just got back from an artificial intelligence conference, and he's got some really interesting news, I think, on that. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Good. Thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Of course.
Tell us what conference you were at, and tell us why we should all be really gloomy about the future of AI.
Well, I start off by saying that I don't necessarily think you have to be really gloomy, but it's certainly something that people should be thinking about. I was visiting the ReWork Deep Learning Innovation Summit, which was focused on sort of machine learning, which is a slightly distinct from artificial intelligence, but there were a bunch of companies talking about, you know, what they were doing for state-of-the-art machine learning tasks, things like speech understanding and image recognition and things like that. And one of the people that was on stage speaking was Andrew Ng, the chief scientist at Baidu, which is a Chinese internet search giant. Mr. Ng previously worked for Google and Coursera and is, pretty well-regarded in the field of machine learning. And he was asked about, you know, the prospect of killer robots and the dangers of artificial intelligence, I think in part because it's been in the news quite a bit with people like Elon Musk and Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking, you know, voicing sort of vague warnings about the threat from artificial intelligence. And what Ng said was essentially that he wasn't all that worried about, super intelligent robots, you know, learning how to create themselves and wiping us out. And he was more concerned about the impact that AI would have on employment. And he cited the example of, you know, self-driving cars and, you know, what it could do to truck drivers, for example. Or, you know, there are a lot of jobs that are potentially open to automation. As I recall, there was something like, there was an Oxford study, and I think it said something like 46% of them were, I'm sorry, maybe it was 76% of them were potentially automatable. And, you know, at some point in the future. And, you know, we can see that happening today. There was just a story in The Verge about the Associated Press's use of automated insights, which is now writing something like 3,000 financial report stories. And these are robots that are generating these financial stories, and they're pretty much just lists of facts about, you know, what company did what and, you know, how much it made and all that. But, you know, these are stories that are that people are not doing. And, you know, the interesting thing about the AP is that currently they say it hasn't cost jobs yet because it's freed reporters to do more interesting work. But I think it would be naive to think that, you know, AI is not going to keep getting better and keep being able to do more and more capable stories. You know, I think that long-term as a journalist, you know, we'll have to become more and more specialized because machines are going to be capable of writing, you know, pretty competently in, you know, a decade or two.
Oh, well, that sounds sort of depressing. I feel like I should quit now. But at the same time, I saw the movie in 1955, Desk Set, where it was predicted that computers would take over all the jobs in 1955. Here we are 60 years later, and all of us have jobs, you know, within reason. Why do we think the warning now matters more? Is it because we're farther along the curve, or is this just sort of silly and we're always just going to find a new job and we just are afraid of technology? What do you think?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say, and it's hard to be too pessimistic about it. I mean, because I think that there will, you know, always be a place for humans doing something. The question is just, you know, how many of us and, you know, doing what? You know, is it acceptable to have, you know, maybe the bottom 30% of the workforce, you know, just simply not that useful for society? You know, that's a question that was tackled in a book called The Second Machine Age, which is very good if you have it, if you're interested in reading about this sort of thing. But, you know, I think things have fundamentally changed from, you know, the what it was in the 50s, 60s, or 70s, or, you know, or before then. I mean, at the deep learning summit, they were talking about the sort of vast amounts of data that are available and, you know, the power that is available through cloud computing. The advances that have come recently allow companies to, you know, derive insights that are orders of magnitude more powerful. And, you know, we can create, you know, value in, we can create so much more value using these tools. Now, in the near term, you know, what you're going to see is people and machines working together. But, you know, the question you have to ask is, why is it that a machine couldn't do all of that? And in a lot of cases, a machine could. I mean, you know, certainly the fact that there are human toll takers now, you know, I don't think there will be in, you know, a couple decades. And, you know, things like clerks at supermarkets, I mean, there's no reason that that has to be done by a human. They already have automated checkout lanes at Safeways, and you know, you have a person in some of them, and other ones are automated. But if the, you know, if Safeway wanted to just make sure that it re-architected its packaging and everything had a little radio transmitter on it, you know, it could track everything with 100% accuracy and wouldn't need, you know, anyone there except a few security guards. And even that could probably be done by robots, you know, given enough sophistication. I mean, it's, I think we fool ourselves by thinking that we're so valuable and irreplaceable that no one could figure out how to do what we do through code. I think that there's quite a bit of what we do that can be automated. Not for everyone, but certainly for a lot of people. And the question that we're going to have to confront is, as a society, is how do we have a society set up like that? And I don't know that there are any really good answers.
Right. Well, I think it sounds great. We let the robots do all the work, and then we also invent the robots that let me lay out on a beach and feed me grapes all the time. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think that sounds like a great idea. A great idea, personally. I think ultimately, you know, if you're lucky, you're going to be an owner of a robot at some point in the future, and then you can just sit back and collect its earnings.
Right, exactly. Well, I guess the thing I'm scared of is the transition, right? It's not the time when none of us have to work. It's the time when half of us work and half of us don't. That seems to be the scary part. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's the social change that is going to be the tricky part. There's a lot of stuff that can be automated now that isn't just because we haven't really done the work yet or because, you know, no one's really thought to. But, you know, you can see with companies like Uber, which, you know, has an ambition to sort of, you know, have everything driving around. And they've talked about the potential for automated cars to get rid of their drivers. I mean, everyone is thinking about it. The question is just, you know, who's going to do it in a way that they can get away with?
Well, I think I'm going to go take classes in robot repair right now, so I still have a job in a few years. But I want to thank you, Tom, for giving us a lot to think about. Where can we follow you to get what you're going to be working on in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I'm always hanging around Twitter, Thomas Klaber at Twitter, and you can find me on Information Week.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, Tom. We're looking forward to reading what you've got for us in the near future.
All right, thanks, Dave.
That just leaves me to thank all of our guests today, Bill Coughlin, Kelly Sheridan, Charlie Babcock, and Tom Claiborne for joining us today. Check me out if you've got a chance at the Geekend. We've got a great article today about binge-watching TV. You can also find me at GeekendDave on Twitter. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I hope you had a great time, and see you at the same time again next week at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. Have a great week.